Central America. The thought evokes mercenaries, low-intensity wars, Contras, refugees, civilian bombings, mining harbors, new song movements, poetry, a culture to be recognized and understood. And here on WBAI, during Central America Week, you'll hear important programs, such as Radio Farabunde Marti. The international representative, Roberto Guterres, talks about the role of revolutionary radio in El Salvador. That's on Monday, March 16th. On Tuesday, March 17th at 8:30, poetry from the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua with Carlos Rigby, a black mosquito Indian. Rigby reads his work and discusses tribal autonomy as practiced by the people in the region. On Wednesday, March 16th at 2:30, Ed Asner reads from the narrative poem With Walker in Nicaragua by Nicaraguan Minister of Culture Ernesto Cardenal. That evening at 9 o'clock, Contragate Live. The WBAI Contragate team organized a public forum last month with guest speakers Noam Chomsky and Jonathan Weiner, the investigative aide to Senator John Kerry. It was recorded live and produced by Judith Callis. On Thursday, the 17th at 8:30, Women Under Fire in Central America. Women from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras tell of their firsthand experience in the struggle in their countries, sharing their hopes, dreams, poetry, and song. That is hosted by Victoria Schultz. And on Saturday, March 21st at 3:30 in the afternoon, The Politics of Sanctuary. Andrew Phillips presents an investigation of the legal, ethical, and religious questions arising from the sanctuary movement in this country. That's all during Central America Week here on WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial in New York.
And you are listening to listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. The time is now 2:31. Coming up next is our arts feature. Today, Edward Asner reads from Ernesto Cardenal's narrative poem With Walker in Nicaragua. Cardenal is Nicaragua's foremost living writer and is considered the most widely read poet writing in Spanish today. He is also Nicaragua's Minister of Culture. That's coming up next. And around 3 o'clock, Free Form Radio with the ubiquitous Rasco. So stay tuned right here on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI in New York City.
You are about to hear Edward Asner reading from Ernesto Cardenal's narrative poem, With Walker in Nicaragua, translated by Jonathan Cohen. Nicaragua's Ernesto Cardenal is considered the most widely read poet writing in Spanish today. Born in 1925 in Granada, Nicaragua, he was ordained a priest in the Catholic Church at the age of 40. His work as a revolutionary priest has become central to his poetics. He has been Nicaragua's Minister of Culture since 1979, the year the Sandinista National Liberation Front overthrew the dictatorial regime of Anastasio Somoza. Cardenal wrote With Walker in Nicaragua in 1950. The poem focuses on the filibuster war of 1855 to 1857 and its central figure, William Walker of Tennessee. In the mid-19th century, filibuster referred to a soldier of fortune who sought to gain control of a foreign country by force. William Walker, the king of the filibusters, was executed by a Honduran firing squad in 1860. According to one U.S. historian, he had, in the decade before his death, become the hottest news personality between the discovery of gold in California and the Civil War. Though lost in U.S. history, he has never been forgotten by the people of Central America. Born in Nashville, Tennessee in 1824, Walker earned a medical degree by the time he was 19, but that profession didn't satisfy him. He then took up law, which he practiced unsuccessfully in New Orleans, until giving it up to run a newspaper there. In 1850, Walker went to San Francisco, where his life would take its most dramatic turn. In California, Walker practiced law and once again became editor of a newspaper. But the mood in the United States favored national expansion, fulfillment of the country's manifest destiny. In 1853, Walker mounted an expedition into northern Mexico. By January of the next year, he had proclaimed Lower California and the state of Sonora an independent republic, with himself as president. Faced with the hostility of the Mexicans and unable to obtain needed food and supplies, Walker and his tattered filibusters returned to the United States border, where he surrendered to American authorities. He stood trial in San Francisco for violating the U.S. laws on neutrality, but was acquitted by a sympathetic jury. In 1855, Walker undertook his second filibustering expedition. There was a civil war raging in Nicaragua between the Democratic and aristocratic parties, the liberals and the conservatives. The Democratic Party offered Walker 20,000 acres of land to fight on its side. In June of that year, Walker arrived in Nicaragua with a force of 56 men, but he soon had an army of thousands, thanks to free passage offered by the American Transit Company of Cornelius Vanderbilt. This company provided transportation across Nicaragua for tens of thousands of men and women heading for the gold fields in California. Shortly after arriving in Nicaragua, Walker and his men suffered defeat when they attacked the town of Rivas on Lake Nicaragua. But then he and his growing army, aided by Nicaraguan allies, won a series of battles, culminating in the capture of the town of Granada. Also located on Lake Nicaragua, Granada was the aristocratic party center of power. The city of León, farther to the north, was the center for the Democratic Party. After the capture of Granada, Walker was, for all practical purposes, the ruler of Nicaragua. As president of Nicaragua, Walker legalized slavery, issued bonds, made English the country's official language, and alienated Vanderbilt by revoking his transit company's concession. Although the U.S. government tended to frown upon Walker's filibustering activities, he did receive considerable support from the slave states. He hoped to make Nicaragua a powerful slave empire and to form a confederation of the Central American states under his leadership. His master plan was to join Central America and Cuba to the southern slave states. Cardinal's documentary poem tells the story of Walker's rise and fall from the sympathetic point of view of an old man, a filibuster in his youth. And now, with Walker in Nicaragua.
In a lonely cabin on the frontier, I, Clinton Rollins, attempting no literary style, pass the time by penning my memories. And as an old man, my thoughts wander back. The things that happened 50 years ago. Spanish Americans I have known, whom I have grown to like, and that warm, sweet, green odor of Central America. The white houses with red-tiled roofs and with wide, sunny eaves, and a tropical courtyard with a fountain and a woman by the fountain, and the heat making our beards grow longer. What scenes return to my memory now? The gray wave that comes blotting out the hills, and a muffled sound of floodwaters rushing through the jungle, and the howls of monkeys on the opposite bank, and then the heavy, metallic beating of raindrops on the tin roofs, and the people running to take in their clothes from the ranch porches, and later the gray wave and the muffled sound moving off, and once again the silence, and how it smelled of underbrush, and the river turned leaf green. Now the little steamboat looked there, calm as could be, anchored to the shade of the jungle. And the sudden flop of an iguana into the water. The rumble of falling timber. The distant shot of a rifle. A Spanish word shouted from afar. The laughter of the black women washing clothes. And a Caribbean song. My companions on that expedition with William Walker, Achilles Kuehn, the aristocrat who fell fighting at Rivas, Chris Lilly, the boxer, his throat cut while drunk one night beside a shining lagoon, William Stoker, Bill, with his pirate's face and a good man, who got married there afterwards and lived by Lake Managua, and I ate once at his house. And Crocker, the pretty boy, who died gasping for breath at Rivas, with his dirty blonde beard heavy with blood, and one arm dangling and a half-empty revolver in the other. Skelter, the bracket, who died of cholera, and Dixie, the newsboy, the bugler, who on the night Colonel Jack broke through the lines was better than the Scottish bagpipes at Lucknow, playing his bugle. De Brissett, Dolan, Henry, Bob, Gray, the bandit, the doubting Thomas, the bum, the treasure hunter. The ones who were hanged from trees and left swinging beneath the stinking black vultures and the moon, or sprawled on the plains with a lone coyote and the moon, a rifle beside them, or in the hot cobbled streets filled with shouts, or white like shells on the seashore, where the tides are always covering and uncovering them. The ones who survived all those dangers and are even still alive. The ones who stayed there afterwards to get married and to live in peace in that land. And who this afternoon probably sit remembering, thinking about how one day they might pen their memories, and their wife who is from that land, and their grandchildren playing. The ones who deserted with Turley inland toward the gold mines and were surrounded by natives and perished. The man who, while sleeping, fell from a boat into the water, dreaming perhaps of battles. And not a soul heard his cries in the darkness, if he did cry out. The ones who were shot by Walker against a great church, and later Walker himself shot. I saw Walker for the first time in San Francisco. I remember him as if I were seeing his blonde face like a tiger's. His gray eyes without pupils, fixed like a blind man's, but which expanded and flashed like gunpowder in combat. And the skin faintly freckled, his paleness, his clergyman's ways, his voice colorless like his eyes, cold and sharp, in a mouth without lips. And a woman's voice was hardly softer than his. That calm voice of his announcing death sentences that swept so many into the jaws of death and combat. He never drank or smoked, and he wore no uniform. Nobody was his friend, and I don't remember ever having seen him smile. We set sail from San Francisco in 55. Achilles Kewen and Bill and Crocker, Hornsby and the others, on board a filibuster brig. No one had done us any harm, and we brought war. When we saw Lake Nicaragua for the first time, upon reaching the front at a bend in the road, we halted with a single exclamation, "Ometepe!" The smooth blue lake and the island, with its two twin volcanoes like breasts, joined at water level by their bases, which looked like they were sinking in the water, and the humble smoke rising from its villages. And through the air's clearness, they seemed close by. And beneath us, that glassy sand, and in the distance, the steeples of the church at Rivas. So Rivas next in the first shots. Walker in front on horseback like a flag. It was noonday and our sun-drenched clothes felt heavy on us. Then Kewen and Crocker were wounded. "Fire!" shouted Kewen. And we ran through the gray-walled street, Crocker with his silver-plated revolver shouting. Rivas was left filled with shouts and blood and fires burning in the sun's glare. And we returned to that blue port nestled in hills, with a curved yellow coconut palm swaying and a small Costa Rican ship in the harbor. There were high winds that night, with the moon swift among the silvery dark clouds, and De Brissett in a hospital bed, angry at Walker. And in Leon, the nights were cool, with distant guitars below wrought iron balconies, and the wind swinging the golden lamps in front of the houses. And as we neared the city, we heard from afar the sentries pacing back and forth, and an
alerta!
One after the other, running from street to street. The voices of the people sounded strange to us, and their words ended faintly as in a song. And the sentry's cry was as musical as a bird's in the evening. One day we embarked on the Virgen for Granada, in front of those two silent volcanoes like two blue guards. The lake was glassy smooth, and all at once herons everywhere flew over the lake, as if great white flowers toward islands where they sleep, and flocks of screaming ducks took off in search of shelter. At night we stopped the trembling engine in front of Granada, and only the waves against the boat could be heard. We covered our lanterns with canvas, dropped anchor stealthily, attached a cable to a tree on the shore, and lowering some launches, we disembarked. No one could see us advancing in the darkness with our black uniforms, the darkness full of fireflies and crickets, hearing every little noise as if a big racket. And by the time the alarm was sounded in the thick towers, it was late, as the dawn suddenly rose from the waters, lighting the foreign streets, grave and empty, of the captured town. With filibusters in black uniform on the street corners, and our flag with its red star at St. Francis. And then there was peace. Walker spoke of peace and national reconciliation, and kneeling with Corral in church, he swore to observe the Constitution. Walker, in good spirits, produced long cavalcades through the streets, but downhearted, Corral never left his house. And that day on which he was arrested, tried by court-martial, the prisoner then threw himself on the mercy of Walker, and Walker, that the prisoner would be shot at noon. Ladies came, with Senora Corral and her three daughters weeping, the youngest two embracing Walker's knees. And he, in between officers and surrounded by his Cuban bodyguards, and we filibusters outside listening in silence, and that man who'd had a sweetheart in Nashville, Helen Martin, a deaf-mute, who died of yellow fever, for whom he learned the language of hands, and together they'd make silent signs in the air, as if a fleeting compassion, like the batting of an eyelid, had then crossed his colorless eyes of ice. Lifting his hand, he said that Corral would not be shot at noon, but at 2 p.m. And outside, we, the filibusters, were hung in doubt. And we saw the town square overshadowed by cloud, the still palm trees, the cathedral, the great stone cross, and at the end of Main Street, like a wall, the leaden lake. And a soldier then,
"Good God, how generous!"
bursting into a loud guffaw. And he had to be taken off so he wouldn't be heard. Corral was shot at 2 p.m. Gilman gave the order. Walker, some distance away, on horseback, not taking part. There was mourning in many houses. We heard the weeping. And afterward there was a great calm, like the calm before a storm. Walker proclaimed himself president, and he decreed slavery and the seizure of estates. Meantime, enemy troops we didn't see were mustering around lagoons. The plague made its entrance with funeral drums that winter. All was peaceful one day, when the first volleys began to be heard drawing near, and the loud vivas on the outskirts, and the noise of weapons and the bullets from rifles nearer and nearer, and the enemy moving fast in the direction of the main square. They left me behind in Granada, so I can tell the story. Unarmed men in their homes killed in front of their families, and a little boy murdered while eating his dinner. Communication with the pier was cut, besieged. Patrols downstairs banging on the doors. And from the enemy boomed laughter and guitars with bonfires during the night. And at daybreak, there were women grief-stricken in the streets. And then came that Englishman, C.F. Henningsen, who fought against the Tsar and in Spain and for the independence of Hungary. If only we could have sailed off right then and left that ruined Granada. The White Castle, as we used to call it, with its blood-stained streets and its stinking wells full of corpses, and the dead's grimaces lit by fires in the streets. We protected ourselves from bullets behind piles of corpses. Day was hot, and the air full of smoke from the fires. And hour after hour, without failing to see them, without failing to see enemy troops, until night finally came, and the rifles quieted down. Henningsen dug trenches that night, and the following day the sun rose up out of the lake like an island of gold, and the shots and the whistling of bullets and the groans let us know one more day of horror had arrived, and we'd come to a foreign land in search of gold, and there black smoke was everywhere, and streets filled with shop goods and corpses. All that could be heard the rest of the day were shots and the moans of those hit by cholera, and the calm voice of Henningsen giving encouragement in balconies where before girls might have been sitting with their governesses. Now riflemen could be seen with their long rifles, and instead of polkas and waltzes, gunfire. By the next day, the last houses on the square were burned down. From afar, the town with shooting and smoke and fireworks looked the way it does on a holiday. The rainy season had ended, and the fever was spreading like a fire. At night, we dumped those dead from cholera into the water, and cries could be heard from the sick who were delirious, begging for water. Water! Water! We threw the corpses into fires, and the acrid smoke they gave off made our eyes red. And that smoke, and the dust, and the sun on the pavement, and the flames from the houses, and the gunpowder dried our mouths more, and soldiers stopped fighting to cough, and were wounded while they coughed, and dropped to the ground still coughing. New plans were made to reach the lake, which shined at the end of the street like glass, white as ice. We knew that many bodies were being burned, and many groans rose from the streets during the night, and from the outskirts the sweet odor of the dead. And Walker, meanwhile, taking dips in the ocean at San Juan del Sur, where the blasts from the cannons did not reach, nor perhaps even our messages. The days went by without receiving any news, and I still relive those days in my dark nightmares. Houses that had been familiar were no longer recognizable, and the streets could hardly be distinguished beneath the rubble. A statue of the Virgin hanging by itself on a black wall, and the ash-colored lake behind the rubble. Water the color of Walker's eyes behind the rubble, which formed odd silhouettes during the night. And I remember a church with nothing left standing but the portico, like a triumphal arch. And those flames spread like wildfire in the street from the lake. And Henningsen's message was,
"Your order has been obeyed, sir. Granada is no more."
Help finally arrived with Walker himself, who stayed on the boat. And we could make out the shots in the night from afar. The water was still and heavy like steel, and the flashes from the rifles reflected like lightning. And it was then that Colonel Jack from Kentucky broke through the lines as Dixie the newsboy played his bugle. And in the darkness of midnight from hill to hill, that bugle shined like a glorious light coming up to us beleaguered souls, making the 350 who came act like an immense army in perfect formation advancing, hitting the dirt all as one and getting up with their long rifles firing. It was nearly 2 in the morning on the 14th when all were on board. Henningsen was the last to leave Granada. He went into the ruined main square and there saw around him the work that had been done. He picked up a dead ember and wrote on a piece of scorched hide the epitaph, "Here was Granada." Then stuck it up on a lance in the middle of the square, and so it was. They loved Granada like a woman. Even today, tears well up in their eyes when they remember the loss of their dear Granada, the town of the Chamorros, where once there was love. I stayed in the country for a while, living in León, and Bill DeShawn, Shipley, Dixie, Bob Gray, Bill Stoker, and others came to see me, and they told me about the second expedition and Walker's death. On the Mississippi one night, he silently weighed anchor and landed on the coast of Honduras late in the afternoon, August 5th. And most likely the 5th of August doesn't go by when they don't think back on that march to Trujillo with a waning moon. Dawn was coming up through the palms when they arrived, to the sharp cry of the sentries, at the fort with stained ramparts and silvery cannons. And they took the fort. The houses were made of stone, with one floor and red-tiled roofs held up by cane poles on top of big beams, and many big iguanas on the roofs. It was there that Henry, drunk, smoking a cigar near the gunpowder, was shot by Dolan, the bullet hitting him right in the mouth. And Walker came quick to gather him up, as Dolan was explaining how it happened. And so Walker sat down at Henry's bedside, and the sun went down, the moon rose, and he was still there, and the whole night went by, and he was still there, applying wet cloths to Henry's wounded face. And in the morning, he left and relieved the guards. Dolan spoke of reinforcements, but they never did come. And then came the ultimatum from the British. Walker entered once more and sat down at Henry's bedside. Henry couldn't speak, so he had a slate on which he wrote. Then they marched out in ranks, each with a blanket and rifle, in search of Cabañas' camp, because that had been Henry's word, Cabañas. They went through a grove of orange trees. They marched swiftly and in silence all night, without stopping to bury their dead. They halted in the evening for the moon to rise, and a guard was posted. They marched more by night. They halted at sunrise at a banana plantation. Bullets were bursting from the leaves. They fired back at them when they stopped to drink, behind banana trees. Walker was wounded slightly on one cheek, the first bullet to wound him in a battle. And they finally reached Cabañas' camp and found the rifle pits, but no Cabañas. What long, hot days those were, in sticky swamps with heavy rifles, from dawn until the blood-red sundowns hot as hell. Walker with fever, paler than ever. And they lost all track of the days, until one day they saw the British coming up the river. General Walker was the last to climb on board.
All that are alive, sir.
It was daylight when they woke up at anchor at Trujillo, and it looked like a grimace hung above the black fort. And they put the wounded under sailcloth awnings. In the fort, they were court-martialing Walker. They saw him pass by the next morning, surrounded by guards, his face pale as always, and they could see the scar paler on his cheek. He carried a crucifix in his hand. When they halted, the officer commanding the guard read a paper in Spanish, surely his orders. And then Walker, in a calm and dignified voice, without trembling, spoke in Spanish. And the filibusters didn't hear what he said. They could see from where they stood a newly made grave in the sand, and Walker, who kept speaking, calm and dignified, beside the grave. And the man said, "The President! The President of Nicaragua is a Nicaraguan." There was a drum roll and gunfire. All the bullets hit the mark. Out of 91 men, only 12 made it back. And there by the sea, with no wreaths or epitaph, remained William Walker of Tennessee.
You have just heard Edward Asner reading from Ernesto Cardenal's With Walker in Nicaragua, introduced by Roberta Pixer. The music is by the group Nankawasu. Jonathan Cohen and Raymond Meyer, the producers of this program, wish to thank Wesleyan University Press for permission to use Mr. Cohen's translation. Special thanks are due Andy Natale, who edited the recording at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. This program was made in cooperation with KPFK in Los Angeles and WBAI in New York.
On Friday, March 20th, from 3 to 5 p.m., WBAI will premiere Moscow, New York Live, featuring musician Paul Winter, Soviet and American futurists, and listener phone calls to and from the Soviet Union. Broadcast live in the USA and USSR. Moscow, New York Live, Friday, March 20th, from 3 to 5 p.m., produced by Joe Adamoff in Gospel Radio and Mary Houston and Alfred Weber, on WBAI.
Well, hello. This is Roscoe. Something Good by Steve Winwood.